And we're going to start off by handing out a sheet. I'm going to call it a worksheet, so you've got something in front of you to concentrate on when you get tired of my voice particularly. Got a very exciting topic. It's the story of Rome and its interaction with the people of God. So today we hope to consider basically what's on these two sheets, why this is such an important topic, or why it's such an important period of history, the predictions that the prophets of God made about it, how Rome rose to become a world power, and the Roman representatives we meet in the Gospel records, which are very interesting. And finally, hope you don't run out of time, the challenge which Jesus actually makes to each of us that we should take home with us and consider. So we'll begin by looking at our key verse in Galatians 4, verse 4.
Oh, too many, sorry. I'll get used to this. Oh. Am I going the wrong way? Yes. Right.
Now, our first reader is going to read Galatians 4, verse 4.
Galatians 4, verse 4. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law.
That's right. So we've got that on our sheet as well. When the fullness of time has come. So I think that's our key verse for this series, that it was all planned by God. And that when the fullness of time has come, which is in the authorised version, I like the expression, every little bit and piece came together. And that was the time that God chose to send his son. So we're looking at what it was about this period of history that made it appropriate for Christ to come. And other translations say most appropriate, right, time appointed. It was the complete fulfilment of all that had been prophesied. And in Romans 5, verse 6, we're told the same thing. When we were still without strength, in due time, Christ died, the ungodly. So Christ came at just the right time. I think it's good to keep that in mind when we think about the second coming as well, when it all comes together, when the fullness of time comes. Now, there were many things happening at the time which indicate that it was the most appropriate time for Jesus to come. And we don't know the mind of God, of course, but we can look at some of the things about this period of history that would indicate that. Now, you probably all know a lot about Rome, so I hope this is not repeating things you know too much. But anyway, this is the main point, so I thought were the most appropriate. Rome had unified much of the world under its government. Looking at our map on the worksheet, which we have here, and I'll bring up on the board as well if I can find it. We see the extent of the Roman Empire at the time of Jesus. It really is quite amazing because Rome brought together people and places as never before. The peace, or the Pax Romana, have you heard of that? That means the peace of Rome. It covered the period from 30 BC, which is 30 years before Christ, to 180 AD. It was a period of peace, stability and productivity for the Roman Empire. It followed the end of the bloody civil wars at the end of the Roman Republic. And for two centuries, the Roman Empire provided relative political stability, and Roman law was enforced throughout the empire. Now, Rome also transformed the world it conquered. We know the expression, all roads lead to Rome. You heard of that? Well, in actual fact, they did. The golden milestone in Rome, erected by the Emperor Augustus, had on it all the distances to the major cities throughout the empire. So they built all these wonderful roadways and road systems throughout the empire. And it meant that the troops could go there very quickly and easily, and it also meant commerce and people could travel as never before. And we know how much this enabled the gospel to be preached. And where the Roman roads went, things changed. The greatest program of urbanisation in history took place because the Romans were great engineers. Wherever they went, they built. And can you think of some of the things they built? Probably aqueducts, still the remnants of these. They mastered the art of the arch, and they were beautiful aqueducts, which we think are boring things, but they made them rather grand. And roads and bridges, baths, walls, Roman walls, amphitheatres and temples. And this was also important in the spread of the gospel, because Paul could go to centres and the gospel spread out from those centres. By the time of Jesus, Rome had gained complete control of the Mediterranean. They like to call it the Roman Lake. Or they also called it Mare Nostrum, which meant our sea, which it was. And the sea routes in the Mediterranean were like busy roads where they knew all the way to go. And they could be used too by the early preachers of the gospel. Now, perhaps not the most important, but one of the other very important things about it was the common language of the empire. Do you know what the common language was? Yes, Greek. That's right. Latin was the official language, but Greek was the common language of the people. So wherever Paul went, if he spoke, he could be understood. Well, I think one of the cities wasn't understood that well. But generally speaking, if you travelled throughout the empire and you spoke Greek, people knew what you were talking about. Mm. It was called Koine Greek, and Koine is the Greek word for common. So it was the common Greek that they spoke and could be understood. And you know the early Gospels were written in Greek, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, all written in Greek, and also Paul's letters were written in Greek, the earliest manuscripts. And the other important thing too was the Septuagint, remember, the Old Testament scriptures had been translated into the Greek language for a few hundred years before, so that the world had got a bit accustomed to the Old Testament, because in all the dispersion of the Jews in their synagogues, the Septuagint was used. So that was very important. But beneath this beautiful world that the Romans had created, there was a darker side. The Roman rule over Israel at the time made the Jews hungry for their Messiah. The yoke of Rome upon them was heavy and greatly resented, so that there was great anticipation that a saviour, their Messiah, would come. So when Jesus was born, people were expecting it. It was sort of that expectation. And amongst the general people, there was a spiritual emptiness. The traditional gods of Rome didn't have much to offer. They were pretty boring, I think. Vesta, the goddess of the hearth and home, she wasn't very exciting. Well, she was sort of like a very primitive goddess. And the foreign gods that had come in from the other side of the empire, they were very exotic and the worship was really over the top. So they didn't really help. They were proved to be ineffective, the pagan gods. Greek philosophy and science did not satisfy people. And amongst the Jews, the legalism of the Pharisees led to bondage of the spirit. So into this world and into this void, the gospel message brought a wonderful message of hope and salvation. Now another factor the dark side of Rome was its dependence on slavery. Slaves were property and as such had no rights. They were employed in colossal numbers to keep the empire going. And when it was proposed at one stage for them to wear distinctive dress, they thought they better not. Because a third or a fourth of people in Rome were slaves. They thought if they wore distinctive dress, well, they might think, well, there's more of us than them, and we'll overcome them. So they decided not to do that. So in the end, we know that the gospel message really appealed to the underprivileged, not exclusively, but it was to the poor and the humble that the gospel had its greatest appeal. And they found in Jesus' teachings a message of hope denied to them in their ordinary life. So no doubt there are other factors which led to God choosing this particular time. And if you can think of some of them, we'll talk about them at the end of class. Now, as we look further at the story of Rome, we can join in the prayer of Daniel. And we're going to get our second reader to read that prayer from Daniel 2. Thank you.
So Daniel 2, verse 22-21. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding."
Thank you. Yes, so that's a marvellous expression, isn't it? God removes kings and he raises up kings. And as we go through the bit of history of Rome, we see this very clearly, that it was God's hand that was there in the raising up of this nation. So, that's right. Okay, our next picture. Yeah.
Oh, no, I've got to get back, sorry. That's it. Right.
You'll even see a little line on your worksheet. Long ago, God had forewarned his people of the rise of great power. As far back as the days of Moses, God had warned Israel that if they disobeyed his laws, a great power would put a yoke of iron on their neck until they were destroyed. We read of Moses' warning to the nation in Deuteronomy 28, verse 49, which our third reader is going to read.
Okay, that's me. The Lord will bring a nation against you from far away, from the ends of the earth, like an eagle swooping down, a nation whose language you will not understand.
Right, thank you. Now, the reference to the eagle I find very fascinating. While the eagle's not used exclusively in the Bible to refer to Rome, we know it's used sometimes for other things, but it did come to be the symbol of the Roman power. It was the emblem of the Roman Empire. It was carried by the Roman standard bearer in the forefront of every battle. If the eagle was captured, the Roman legion would expand. From Britain to Palestine, it was the recognised and often hated symbol of Roman overlordship. Even today, I find this interesting, a symbol of the eagle with the letters SPQR, the Senate, means the Senate, and the people. I think the Q means of or and the Republic, so it was first used for the Republic. It's used as the municipal symbol of the city of Rome, even today, which is quite interesting. Now, we've got other references, too, that God forewarned the people of what was coming. And what's our next one? Yes, the familiar one, which we're going to read about with our reader.
Number 4?
Yeah, thank you.
Daniel 2, verse 40. "And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all others."
Right, so what an appropriate symbol for the Roman power. As symbolised by the metal iron, Rome was the strongest of all the four kingdoms depicted in the image. Rome was the tough, iron-fisted kingdom which clamped down with military rule over the entire known world in the days before Christ. I think the legs in the image are particularly appropriate because it reminds us again of the roads and the march of the Roman soldiers, so well known. And perhaps even the two legs, the western and the eastern division of Rome. And there's another one, of course, we've seen before, which is
this one.
Also depicted as a beast, Rome was depicted as a beast. This is the conventional interpretation of Daniel, of course, in Daniel 7, verse 7, and our fifth reader.
Daniel 7, verse 7. After this, I saw in night visions.
Can we have it louder? Big voice, please.
After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, so that's rather a frightening picture, isn't it? Stamping the residue with its feet. Okay. And people have always tried to depict it in different ways. There's one artist's idea of that beast there at the end there. I don't know if you can see. But anyway, you've got another picture here on your sheet of the beast. Right, with the 10 horns. So that was conventionally we've always understood that to be Rome. We might have other ideas. Right, now we'll go back to our map again. So you've got your map in front of you, and I'll go back to it here as well.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
It never go as far as Scotland, did it?
No.
Scotland's a very proud...
That's right, that's too hard. Yeah,
Adrian's Wall.
That's right. Yeah, they were the barbarians that they couldn't conquer. So we can see from our map that by the time of Jesus, the Romans had come to dominate all the nations surrounding the Mediterranean Sea, as well as nations beyond, not Scotland. I don't think they'd invaded quite by that time either. That was a bit later, a little bit later. They tried. So Rome set the borders that would eventually define England, Spain, France, Germany and Italy. Rome developed enormous control over the Mediterranean world and Middle East for a longer period than any empire or culture of the modern world. Fairly amazing, right? Now, how did a city-state like Rome rise to become such a world power? What was it that set Rome apart and enabled her to dominate world history for so many centuries? Depending on how you count it, the empire was 1,400 years. Amazing, isn't it? Now, many things account for it. These include her central position. I've never been to Rome, but some of you I'm sure have. So she's centrally located in Italy, right? She was a military genius. We could have a whole class talking about how fantastic her army was, but that's not really my forte. She was very adaptable to change when she needed to change, to meet challenges, and she developed a very stable and just system of government. She didn't just conquer, she also learned how to govern. So some of the other empires are good at conquering, but they didn't last long because they didn't know how to govern. Now, the usual method of conquerors at the time was to brutally subjugate and exploit their conquered nation. But Rome treated her new subjects rather differently. She did brutally conquer, but she also tried to incorporate them into her empire. Sometimes some groups were immediately pacified by being made Roman citizens, and other communities were allowed to have control over their own affairs, provided they did what she said in foreign affairs. And her intelligent treatment of other neighbouring lands gained her devoted support, and she built up a whole system of alliances with loyal allies. Mind you, if you were an ally and you didn't do what she wanted, watch out. She was brutal. So we could say that the Romans were masters of war, and they became masters in the art of governing others as well. Now, the story of her rise, you may know a little bit about it. Have you heard of Romulus? Romulus and Remus, well, that's the fable. I don't think that's true, but the two twins that were suckled by the wolf, the she-wolf. Anyway, a lot is not known about very early history because there wasn't records. according to Roman legend, the city of Rome was founded by Romulus in 753 BC. She was initially ruled by kings, apparently seven. We don't know if that's exactly accurate. And first of all, she was simply a city-state built on two hills. She drained the area between the hills and established herself on seven hills of Rome, built a wall around herself and became very strong, defeated the Etruscans to the north and the Latin people to the south, and started to spread over the Mediterranean area. However, she had a big enemy in this part, in the western part of the Mediterranean. She came across her greatest foe, who was that? They were nasty lot, but Julius Caesar tried to tackle him a bit later, so. But anyway, Hannibal. Heard of Hannibal? Hannibal's not. It's so exciting. Once you start reading about Hannibal, if you get the chance, it's really fantastic. It's, not that I'm into battles much, as Val said, they're a bit boring, but Hannibal is boring. It's really, really exciting learning about Hannibal. But anyway, Hannibal was like Rome's worst nightmare. He was determined to crush them, and he had vowed to his father that he would. And there were three Punic Wars, three great wars that nearly destroyed Rome as she was expanding, but she was not destroyed. In the end, she destroyed Hannibal and the Carthaginians. So, does anybody know where Carthage was? It's not on the map because it got wiped out. That's why it's not dotted on the map.
Somewhere on the coast.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Really, long-legged get people in for Sicily. That's Sicily. And was there where Tunis is.
Right.
In Tunisia. So Carthage was there. And that was a great, strong nation. And Rome, in the end, there was a clash between the two. Hannibal vowed to destroy Rome. I can't go into it, but I could if I'd. I won't, because we haven't got time. But that's why you've got a picture here at the bottom of the remarkable journey of Hannibal across the Alps into Italy itself. So I've got a nice picture of this. Yes, there he is.
So what countries did he have control of, Hannibal?
Well, Carthage had an empire that actually went into Spain, and they had control of the Western Mediterranean.
Okay.
This is 500 years before Christ. Mm-hmm. So we'll get to Christ soon. Yeah, so they had a big empire, and they were very great with their boats and trading. They were very dominant. So it was inevitable that Rome and Carthage would come into conflict. So Hannibal, who vowed to destroy them, set off from Spain, and unbeknownst to the Romans at the time, with his army and elephants, which I can hardly believe, he got up and came along, gathered people to help him on the way, and invaded Italy. Came across the Alps. In the middle of Utah. And came into it and terrorised the Romans on their own soil for years. And he came close to destroying Rome. He was within 100 miles of invading Rome, the city of Rome itself. And the big question of ancient history is, why didn't he? Why? He had three great battles where he defeated the Romans, and he was within 100 miles of marching on Rome, and he didn't march for it. So that's, people always have this great debate, well, why didn't he do it? So we could say, probably the hand of God, that God sets up kings in the
right. sense.
But, you know, if you go into more detail than that about it. But in the end, Hannibal was defeated, and in the end, Carthage itself, in the Third Punic War, it was burnt to the ground by the Romans. They decided that establish a rise again after Hannibal, and they said, no, it's got to go. They burned it. It took 10 days to burn. It had been a city in existence for 700 years, and the Roman general apparently did weep. That's one thing. He did weep as it burnt. But, you know, they had that ruthlessness about them with the conquering. But on the other hand, they weren't. You know, they had another side, two sides to them. Now, in the eastern part of the Mediterranean, which is... Oh, get back to that. Sorry, I'm getting mixed up now. Things were a bit different. Right, things were a bit different. I'll get back to that. Now, we're talking more about from Italy over to Greece and the Middle East now. What happened there, things were different. There was not one dominant ruler. There were more kingdoms than the Greek kingdoms, which there were four of them, getting weaker and weaker. And Rome gradually took over at all. But Rome was often invited in as a friend, like to settle a dispute, but then she never left. It's like a guest, you know, you invite into your home, you should come and stay and sort out this family problem, please. And then they had to go, they take over. So that's what Rome did. She did in the areas over here. Basically, that's what happened. And she took over, she did a ruthless thing too with Corinth. You know where Corinth is in Greece? Mm-hmm. Yeah. She burnt that to the ground too. And destroyed all the men, took off the women and children as slaves. Because they annoyed her, you know, whatever they did. And they took all the wealth of Corinth. It was the wealthiest city in Greece. And they took all that. Look. And then further here, getting closer now to Israel, they interacted here with the king of the north of Israel and the king of the south, which was, we won't go into their names because I have to think twice about the Ptolemies and the, Seleucids and the Seleucids to the north, the Syrian Greeks. And the Ptolemies to the south, the Egyptian Greeks, she took over them as well, and eventually she invaded Israel. We'll hear a bit more about that in a moment. And in Rome itself, it was the Republic at this stage, great generals were rising up, and they were starting to fight each other. You've probably heard the names of two of the most dominant ones. One was Pompey the Great, and the other one was Julius Caesar. And they were fighting each other. They were using the Roman armies to fight each other in the end. So the Roman Republic, before the birth of Christ, was slipping into a bit of anarchy in a way, because they were using their resources against each other. And then the Pax Romana, which was, you know, I don't know, it happened. Right, so from the year 63 BC, right about that, we'll get to it. To the year 313 AD, Rome is in control of Israel. A long period of time, isn't it? Now, before that, as we've heard in the last class about the Maccabees, Israel had been independent. For 80 years, they were independent under the Maccabees. But it wasn't all totally good, because in the end, they started to descend in civil war. And the dynasty of the Maccabees, which was called the Hasmonean dynasty, there were two brothers that each wanted to be rulers. And their names were Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, if it says that. And Pompey at the time
was here in the Mediterranean, and he heard about civil war. And the Romans liked civil wars because they could come in. And so he decided he invaded the land of Palestine or Judea and invaded Jerusalem. One of the brothers' army opened the doors up to him virtually and said, you know, you're welcome because you're going to take our part. And he took over the city. And from that time on, 63 BC, was Pompey who invaded the land and took over control. And from that time on, the Jews had to do what the Romans said. But they allowed one of the Maccabean kings to remain, and that was, his name was Hyrcanus, one of the brothers, but he was a weak ruler, and he couldn't actually rule properly, and also he couldn't collect the taxes, and that was the most important thing to the Romans. And because of that, he had a very clever advisor who was an Idumean, which means an Edomite, and he said, I can do a better job. And he got in favour with Rome, and he said, my two sons, one of whom was Herod, he can rule. And the Romans agreed to it, and that's how Herod, an Idumean, came to be the ruler at the time of Jesus. It's a rather sad story, isn't it, of all that did happen. And the Romans supported Herod because he was strong and he could collect the taxes and he kept the people in order. So even though the Jews hated him, he was in that situation. Now, before we look in a bit more detail at the Roman rulers in the land, we're going to sing about our king. Because our king is very different from the Roman rulers. So we're going to sing hymn 299. Now, before considering the Roman rulers, if you want to turn your worksheet over to the next page, that's, we're going to be dealing with the second page now. I'll try and cover some of these aspects. And before considering it, there's a couple of points just that I want to make. And the first is this, just so we don't get confused. The actual date of Jesus' birth is not North BC, which I'm not sure it is. That's not North BC. Scholars agree that it's actually somewhere between 6 BC and 4 BC. Now, that's, you can't think that doesn't matter, but sometimes it does matter because if you read about Herod the Great, his rule finished 4 BC, so you think, oh, well, he wasn't a king then, but he was. So the birth of Christ was somewhere there. And the other thing which I think is encouraging too is how true the Bible record is to the character of the men as described by historians of the time. The Bible record is very much in accord with secular history when it comes to the description of the men who ruled at the time, and also some of the detail that people scoffed at, but archaeology has proved quite a few things that they said, well, who was Pontius Pilate anyway, who knows what he was the ruler then. And they found things that have verified that the Bible is true, and I think you can take great courage from that. You know, we know the certainty of the things that we've been told before. So, the Roman emperors at the time of Christ, here is the first one. I'll show you if I can find him. There he is. Does anybody know who it was?
Augustus.
Augustus, yeah. Caesar Augustus, right? He's your first one there. So we're not very far into the New Testament because before we become aware of the presence of the Roman eagle overshadowing the land. And Luke 2, verses 1 and 2, tells us about this, so we've got our sixth reader.
In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be enrolled. This was the first enrollment when Quirinius was governor of Syria.
Yes. And
That's right. And so all went to be registered, everyone to his own city. That's right. So this majestic statue of Augustus was created during his reign, and it was intended to make him look great. Which you're probably not saying it wasn't, but you know, the way his face and the way his hands spread out, and you know, he's got power, and he certainly did. So he was the Roman emperor from 27 BC until 14 AD, a period of 41 years. So he was reigning before the birth of Jesus and during the early years of Jesus' life. He was the great-nephew and adopted son of Julius Caesar, who had been assassinated in 44 BC. Remember Julius Caesar? A2 Brute, 22 blows, he was dead. But his real name is not Augustus. Does anybody know what his real name was? That was just a title, Augustus, actually. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Gaius Octavius.
No,
Octavian. His real name was Octavian.
Oh, okay.
Augustus was a title given to him by the Senate, and it means most revered one.
Okay.
Or more than human. He wasn't sort of heavily worshipped, but they knew he had power. And he was made the princeps, which was the most important Roman. The possessor of more power than any.
Those dates again.
What, oh, sorry. 27 BC until 14 AD. Mm-hmm. So he came to power at the end of a century of bloody civil war that had nearly ruined Rome. He brought peace to the Roman world after the troubled times of the late Republic, and his reign was marked by peace and security, the famous Pax Romana. He was known. He was known for his lavish buildings. He said proudly that he found Rome a city of brick, and he made it a city of marble. And he actually did. He did that. And he spent huge sums beautifying Rome. He restored, for example, 82 temples in Rome itself. Oh, temples, isn't it? That's
really great.
And he encouraged a revival of the ancient Roman virtues, which he thought the gods of Rome, you know, personified. And he passed laws against gambling and not having children and even things like that. Yeah, so, you know, he's trying to uphold the values that he thought were important. So he wasn't a flashy Caesar-like general. He worked carefully to establish the laws of the empire, and the laws he established and administered lasted for a couple of hundred years. So he laid the foundation, really, of the empire. And as well as that, he tried to improve administration of the provinces, of which Judea was one, Israel was one. But he didn't want the Romans to intervene in everything to do with the provinces. They were to look after their own affairs as much as possible, as long as there was no strife and no doing anything that we needed to do with Rome and get attacked. And as long as they paid their taxes. And because he was so generous to his own people, his formula was bread and circuses. Okay, so the bread and the circuses to keep the ordinary people happy. So you entertain them, and when they put on the circuses, he fed the Roman families. They were waiting for the food came from the provinces. So the provinces were the ones who were taxed, and they had to supply heavily the Roman lovely way of life. Thank you very much. In Jerusalem, they left the Jewish state as much as they could with their own rulers, which the Jews didn't like. That was Herod. And the Sanhedrin, as we know from the Gospel records, was left there. They were the Supreme Court in Israel to judge the local matters, but they could not impose the death penalty. So, in their efforts to find suitable ways of maintaining order in Judea, the Roman authorities took considerable pains at first to consider the religious feelings of the Jewish population. For example, they prohibited the introduction of statues and pictures into Jerusalem. So you might have had pictures of the emperor right throughout the empire, but not in Jerusalem, not in Israel, because the Jews revolted. They thought it was against their law. And yeah, that's right, we weren't allowed to have that sort of thing, yeah. So if that was brought into Jerusalem, the Jews would pick up such a fuss that the Romans gave in. And referring back to our quotation in Luke that we just read, we see that there was a perfect time for Jesus' birth in Bethlehem to occur. It was the time when Augustus ordered a census to be taken of the people of the Roman Empire. He was the first one in history to order a census of the whole provincial empire. Roman historians record that Augustus, I'll quote this, revived the office of the censor, which had long been disused, and whose duty it had formerly been to take an account of the number of the people. So this census required that Mary and Joseph leave Nazareth and go to Bethlehem at just the time Jesus was to be born, so that he would be born in the city that was prophesied in the scriptures, Bethlehem. Undoubtedly, you can see the hand of God in that. I think it's rather amazing, isn't it? Now, the other Roman emperor who's mentioned by name in the New Testament is Tiberius Caesar. We've got a picture of him there, the next one. And we read of him in Luke 3:1-2, reading number 7. Okay.
Now, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate, being governor of Judea, and Herod, being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother, tetrarch of Iturea, and of the region of Trachonitis, and Licinius, the tetrarch of Babylonia,
Right. The word of God then came to John. So we haven't skipped through that thing, we don't care about those people. We get to John. But Luke is very careful to give us the historical setting in which Jesus and John the Baptist operated. And so we see that the emperor at the time of John the Baptist was Tiberius, and he was the son of Augustus, and he succeeded Augustus when he died in 14 AD. And he reigned through the ministry of Jesus until his death in 37 AD. So Tiberius was the main one, who was the emperor, during the ministry of Jesus, the emperor Tiberius. He was an able statesman, and he continued with the administrative reforms of Augustus. But as a person, just out of interest, he was a cold, suspicious, disillusioned man who repeatedly made brutal assaults on those he suspected of trying to undermine his position. That's just how he was. But I don't think that affected the Jews, you know, because he was a father. And the other Roman emperors on our worksheet are also related to Augustus. They are Caligula, Claudius, and Nero. But that's not part of the gospel.
That would have affected. Was he the one around Jesus' death?
Pontius Pilate.
Tiberius.
Was he the one who what?
Was he the emperor at Jesus' death?
He was the emperor at the time of Jesus' death, but Pontius Pilate was the one who made the decision.
Yes, but see, they were saying if you don't, like, we'll tell the...
We'll tell Tiberius, we'll yeah, tell, true.
Yeah, so yeah. He's quite a nasty person, that would
yes,
be.
Yes, that's right.
Well, the reason why he wouldn't want it crossing.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he didn't want a bad report going back to Tiberius.
Yes,
that you can't control these people. In the end, Pontius Pilate was recalled. Because he was too cruel, though. Not because he wasn't cruel enough, he was too cruel.
Oh, okay.
He was recalled,
yeah.
When did Tiberius die? He died in... Yeah, 37 AD. Yeah, so he was the emperor too.
And then, when did he start?
He, 14 AD to 37 AD.
He actually co-ruled with Augustus for 2 years.
Right.
Yeah, because Augustus lost the plot at the end.
Right.
So sometimes his reign is considered to be from 12 AD.
Okay. And he was actually adopted son, wasn't he? Like, you know, the previous marriage of Livia. But anyway. Yeah. Okay, now, The family tree of Herod. Sorry, I'm not very good on family trees, so if I get you confused. Oh, I don't like family trees, but anyway, we'll have a go. So if you have a look at your family tree of Herod, and I'll bring up this other one that I've got here, the family tree.
Which is slightly different to yours, but the one I tried to get on, it wasn't, didn't come up clear enough, so this relates to the confusion because it's slightly different.
Oh, my word.
We might stick to this one.
I think so.
Yeah. Now, the thing to remember about the Herods, there is not just one Herod.
No,
there are several men in the New Testament referred to as Herod. That's why it's confusing.
Yeah.
Now, these Herods were part of a dynasty which came to be known as the Herodian dynasty. They were Idumean rulers. That means, you know, originally from... during the days of the Roman Empire. And unlike previous kings of Israel, they were appointed by the Roman emperors and the Senate. So the Jews didn't choose them. Herod was the family name. If you think of Herod as being a family name, that makes it easier. So Herod was the family name of these Roman rulers who served as provincial governors of Palestine and the surrounding regions during New Testament times. Now we read about the first Herod in Matthew 2 verse 1. And our eighth reader.
Now, Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. Behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem.
That's right, saying, where is he who is born king of the Jews? Well, if you imagine how he got this question. Okay, so Herod the king, this is in the early chapters of Matthew, is Herod the Great. Okay. He was the Roman ruler of Palestine when Jesus was born. Now, the only biblical reference to him is this story here in Matthew of his slaying the children in Bethlehem. All the other Herods mentioned in the New Testament were the sons or the grandsons of this Herod the Great. Okay, so we've got Herod the Great up the top of our family tree, sitting up there. That's Herod the Great, is the one that killed the children of Bethlehem. And he died tonight.
That's good. Six wives. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 wives.
Yes, he had a few wives. And he had a few children, but he got rid of some of them. He was that sort of man. So he ruled from 37 to 4 BC. And he was a vassal of Rome. And he found it hard to get control of the Jews, but he did. Once he got control of them, he was very strong. He had been born in Idumea, which is the Edom of the Old Testament, which the Jews would not have liked, would they? His father, Antipater, was by descent an Edomite, whose ancestors had converted to Judaism. So Herod the Great was brought up as a Jew. But the Jews didn't believe he really was a Jew because he had a decadent lifestyle. And strict Pharisees, they said, well, you know, how can you say he's a Jew? And he tried to be sensitive to the Jews, but often he was insensitive to a lot of things he did. But Augustus liked him because he was a great builder, and he was known for all the building that he did. He was very generous to other people too. He built things for them, and he built things Caesarea and called it after Caesar, and he got himself really in favour with the Romans. And the thing that we know him most for is the thing that he built in Jerusalem, which was the temple. Right. And he went to great trouble to build it. But he died, of course, before it was built. It wasn't actually completed until 62 AD, the temple. It took that long. But he had the plans for it. And he tried to do the right thing by the Jews, not do it on site. Everything was prepared and bought. And all the sacrifices were not interfered with. The Sabbath things were, the feasts all kept going. So he spent lavish amounts of money on his building projects. And who paid for it?
The people.
Probably told with our government, who's going to pay for it? So they weren't... These great building campaigns were not possible without taxing the peoples of Galilee, Samaria and Judea greatly, leaving the majority in poverty. Not only were they required to pay taxes to the empire, but also the tithes and the sacrifices of the Jewish religion. So they were ground down, really, during the time of the Romans. Now, the other interesting thing about Herod, which fits in the Bible record, is that he weeded out from his family anybody who he thought was going to have power or take over his power. Now, these are some of the people he got rid of. His uncle Josephus, the guardian of his favourite wife, Mariamne. Mariamne herself, his wife, one of his wives.
She was his favourite.
I know. Yeah, she was. But I don't know.
Well, no, she wasn't.
At one stage, when he was going to die, he couldn't bear the thought she might remarry, so he arranged to have her killed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but I don't know that's how she did die in the end, I think, but that was part of it. So that's some man was. He later had his two young sons, Aristobulus and Alexander, strangled. So they're the two on your chart, coming down from Sunday in Miami. Aristobulus and Alexander died 7 BC. Two of them. Oh. And he had them strangled in Samaria. He asked the emperor if he could have them strangled. He said, okay, but not in Judea. As long as it's not in Judea.
Oh.
So he got them strangled in Samaria.
Because he was just going to knock off the family and live forever, wasn't he?
Yeah. And 5 days before his own death, he had another son, Antipater, which is the other one there, killed as well. And when... So the Emperor Augustus said it would be better to be one of Herod's pigs than his son, that famous statement.
Oh,
no, true, because he didn't kill his pigs, but he did kill his
son. You shouldn't
have had any pigs. It really was a good Jew, wasn't it?
So that's very true, isn't it? You know, imagine him being said, where is he, a former king of the Jews? You know, what a man's so up to.
Sorry, what time did he die?
4 BC.
So, but these sons were killed in 7?
7 BC.
Oh, yeah, so
yeah.
We're going backwards.
We're going, oh, no, you've got to think twice.
I know, yeah. Yeah.
I know, that's
good. Yeah, 7 BC.
Okay.
So, at the end of his reign, anger and dissatisfaction were common among the Jews. Heavy outbreaks of violence and riots followed his death in many cities, including Jerusalem. And when he died, his kingdom was divided into 4, and the Romans agreed to do that. So we come to the descendants of Herod. So all the other Herods mentioned in the New Testament are the sons or grandsons of Herod the Great.
Mm-hmm.
3 sons of Herod the Great ruled parts of the territory previously administered by their father. So we'll get to our map of Israel, which you've got there, which is a bit hard to read. So. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of split up between these. And they were called tetrarchs because tetrarch means a fourth part. And I think we've got 3 of the sons, but I think one part went to a daughter, which is not mentioned. So, now these are... Now the main one is Herod Antipas, or he's called Herod the Tetrarch. He was the main one you hear about in the Gospel record. He's the nasty one. They got rid of John the Baptist, right? So, after the death of Herod the Great in 4 BC, the Romans appointed Herod's son Antipas as governor of Galilee in the north, up there, so that's mainly where Jesus was, and Perea, there, in that part, and he's referred to as Herod the Tetrarch. And he's also known as Herod Antipas. So his reign was from 4 BC to 39 BC, a period of over 40 years. So his reign covered almost the entire life of Jesus. Okay. From 4 BC to 39 BC. So he's the Herod of Jesus, right?
39 AD.
AD.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's right. AD, sorry. I've got that wrong written down too. AD, yeah, that's right. So, he was responsible for building projects like his dad. He built his own capital, Tiberias, on the Sea of Galilee. And he's mentioned, he's best known today for his role in the killing of John the Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
And because John the Baptist challenged him about marrying his wife, well, He took the wife, if you look at the family chart, which I've read, Herodias, who was the wife of Philip. He took her, as we know it. And then he's mentioned four times in connection with Jesus. So the first one is when he thinks, he hears about Jesus being in his territory. He thinks, oh, it's John the Baptist, risen from the dead. So he had a guilty conscience, didn't he? He immediately associated this righteous preacher with John the Baptist. And that was in Matthew 14. Now the second account is when Jesus calls him a fox. That's where I've got the picture of the fox there. So he is the fox. This is Herod Antipas is the fox. So we're going to read about that in Luke 13, 32, our ninth reader. Can we do that now?
But he said to them, go and tell that fox, look, I'm casting off demons and performing healings today and tomorrow. And on the third day I will complete my work.
Yeah, thanks, sir. So then we have Jesus calls him a fox. Now, in our culture, we think, oh, that means he's cunning. But in their culture, it meant you're not as great a ruler as you think you are. You're insignificant. Because if somebody was called a lion, that meant they were important. Mm-hmm. But if you're a fox, you're destructive, but you're not, you know, nobody. Yeah. So he's putting him in his place. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid of you, but Jesus is saying, God is in charge. My death will occur in God's time, not your time. I think that's how I understand it. And then, of course, three occasions. So the third occasion, which we all know about, is when he was sent. Jesus was sent to this Herod, Herod the Tetrarch, by Pilate. Because Pilate said, oh, he's been preaching in Galilee, I'll send you off to Herod. Because Herod, you know, that's Herod's territory, he can sort out this matter as to whether Jesus is guilty or not. So it's the third occasion in which Herod plays a role. And it's not a very nice role, is it? Because soldiers mock Jesus. Now the other Herod is Philip the Tetrarch. He's also mentioned in Luke. And he was a goody on the Sabbath. He was in this other area, east of Galilee, up in more this area. And he did the right thing, apparently. It's only mentioned once in the New Testament by Luke when he says Philip the Tetrarch. Now, the other Herod, which is mentioned in the Bible, is Herod Archelaus. Can you find him on the... Mm-hmm. I don't know what the glasses are. Sorry. He's the third son. Now, he took the major part, in fact, the major cities when Herod the Great died, and he was made ruler of Samaria, Judea, and Idumea. So he was the ruler there, Judea, Samaria, and Idumea, for 10 years. But he was recalled because he was too savage and didn't rule the way that Augustus liked him. So in about 6 AD, Augustus deposed and exiled him to Gaul. To France. He didn't pop in his head, but so he went off there. Then this is how Pontius Pilate comes into the picture. The Romans directly appointed a Roman governor into this area. So that's why Pontius Pilate came to be the ruler or the governor, because Herod's son, I didn't like the job he was doing, Herod Archelaus. I just got rid of him, and Pontius Pilate. No, not straight away, sorry. They did appoint, Pontius Pilate was the fifth governor, Roman governor, that came into that area. So no more Herods in that part. And the other thing about too, that the Syrians were made more or less in charge of what happened, so they had to answer a bit to Syria as well after that. So... Now, sorry, I don't know if this is too complicated, do you think? We've had enough?
Yeah.
Well, we'll just get to Pontius Pilate. Okay.
It's fascinating.
We'll get to Pontius Pilate. Now, we're going to read about him and Margaret and Val are going to enact what we know about Pontius Pilate. I would like you to When we read this Gospel of John about Pontius Pilate, we often concentrate on what Jesus said, but Margaret's going to be Pontius Pilate, and if we just can concentrate on the way he deals with the situation, and if we can learn something about him, and perhaps a lesson for ourselves. So we're reading from John 18.
And just to make it clear, I'm reading this part.
You're just reading the parts for the and Bell's the narrator. So Margaret's the Pontius Pilate.
You're the pink.
Yes, I'm the pink.
Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from the Pilatus to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and asked,
"What charges are you bringing against this man?"
"If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate said,
"Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law."
"But we have no right to execute anyone," they objected. This took place to fulfil what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus and asked him,
"Are you the King of the Jews?"
"Is that your own idea," Jesus asked, "or did others talk to you about me?"
"Am I a Jew?"
Pilate replied.
"Your own people and chief priests handed you over to me. What is it you've done?"
Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now, my kingdom is from another place."
"You are a king then,"
said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You say that I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me."
"What is truth?"
retorted Pilate. With this, he went out again to the Jews gathered there and said,
"I find no basis for a charge against him, but it's your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the King of the Jews?"
They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they slapped him on the face. Once more Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there,
"Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him."
When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them,
"Here's the man."
As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify! Crucify!" But Pilate answered,
"You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him."
The Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid and he went back inside the palace.
"Where do you come from?"
he asked Jesus, but Jesus gave him no answer.
"Do you refuse to speak to me?"
Pilate said,
"Don't you realise I have power either to free you or crucify you?"
Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a great sin." From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jewish leaders kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about noon.
Here is your king,
Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, take him away, take him away, crucify him.
Shall I crucify your king?
Pilate asked. We have no king but Caesar, the chief priest answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified.
Might leave it there. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Oh, well, actually, thank you. Yeah. Behold. Behold the man.
And there we see the dilemma of Pilate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he knew he was innocent, but because it was going to affect him and not being in his favour, he gave way to the popular. So there's that sort of dilemma in life, or the politician's dilemma often, isn't it? Do the right thing or the popular thing? And same probably in our own lives, we might face situations like that. Are we going to do the right thing, or are we going to do what's convenient and won't affect us? Do you know what I mean? We'll do the right thing if it doesn't affect us, but it affects us, or we're not just forgiven. So I think that's the reason for us. And sorry, I'll bring this to an end. I know I'm going a bit long, but a couple more things just to see the that Pilate, as I did mention, they thought Pilate, did he exist or who was he anyway? But they have found this thing called the Pilate Stone. Has anybody seen it? Or been there? Yeah. Well, it was found at Caesarea, and you can't read that there, but it's on your sheet, you can't read it either. But the wording does say Tiberius, and Pontius, and I think he's got procurator, probably actual words, so it's a part. It indicates that he was the procurator at the time of Tiberius and in Judea.
You can see the Pilatus in the second.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. So
historians would have mentioned him though, wouldn't they?
Yes, but they weren't contemporary. There was no contemporary historian, so there were some records of him, but not a lot. And they sort of said, the Bible record's probably not accurate. You know how they dismissed it. But it was 1961 that was discovered. It's in the Israel Museum.
Who was it?
It was found at Caesarea.
Right.
And it was apparently a foundation stone of something that they built to honour Tiberius. I think it might have been an amphitheatre or something. And it had that inscription on it, to Tiberius, and with Pilate's name as well. Mm. So it's fantastic, isn't it? Some of these things that vindicate the Bible. Mm. Really great. And then that's just another challenge, you know, how Jesus said, render to Caesar the things of our Caesar, but render to God the things that are God's. So the Herodians, they didn't care about the things of God, so they were trying to challenge Jesus, but Jesus throws the challenge back at them. The things of Caesar don't matter that much, you know what I mean? Render to God the things that are God's. So the Herodians were just concerned about their own position and favouring Herod's and being in favour with the Romans and all that. So that's another challenge for us. And finally, that quotation that brings together about the fullness of time. This is what we hope for the second coming of Christ. In the dispensation of the fullness of the times, God might gather together in one all things in Christ, both which are in heaven and on earth in him. Mm-hmm. So that's our great fullness, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Thank you.